Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. So in case y'all haven't been able to tell, I've been enjoying the heck out of our series on prehistory and the deep human past. It's like entering a whole new world every week. It's populated by people who are both just like us and deeply different at the same time. One of the ways we try to understand the lives of people we find in the archaeological record is through parallels with more recent societies, particularly foragers. But this is an approach that's full of pitfalls and potentially misleading comparisons, ones that can obscure as much as they actually tell us. That's one of the reasons why I'm so excited to talk to our guest today. He's one of the world's leading experts on recent and contemporary hunter-gatherers and a really experienced archaeologist, so he can speak to both of those fields in really compelling ways. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Wyoming and the author of numerous papers and books, most recently The Fifth Beginning, What 6 Million Years of Human History Can Tell Us About Our Future, which is really fascinating and insightful, and The Life Ways of Hunter-Gatherers, The Foraging Spectrum. Professor Robert Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you about contemporary hunter-gatherers. At a really basic level, your work is predicated on the idea that foragers do things that make sense. They make calculations about what foods to gather, what technologies they use to do that, how far to move, when, and so on. Is that a reasonable way of summing up human behavioral ecology?
It's pretty close. They're doing things that make sense. But when we say make sense, we really mean things that give them an evolutionary advantage. Because if the things people are doing don't give them an evolutionary advantage as a species, then they shouldn't be here. That's the basic assumption. So they're doing things that make sense, although often times if you go and live with foragers, they'll do things that you go, what the heck is going on now? This makes no sense to me. But all anthropologists have that feeling all the time. And anyone who's traveled internationally can go to France today and sit in Paris and go, what the heck are they doing now? Things don't make sense to us because there are different cultures. So human behavioral ecology is designed to try and understand why it is that this great variability in human life in an evolutionary framework.
At a basic level, everybody's got to eat. Everybody is on some level striving to reproduce. And when you have those basic constraints operating within an environment, you're going to have to engage in behaviors that allow you to survive there, that allow you to survive, reproduce, and pass your genes on.
Yeah. But what really constitutes an evolutionary advantage is really dependent upon conditions. And the conditions of today are not exactly the conditions of the past. And that's one reason why you can't just go out and observe hunter-gatherers and think, oh, now I've seen prehistory, because you haven't, because the conditions of today are not the conditions of the past. There's also the kind of wild card of culture, because humans can decide for whatever sort of historical reason, often lost to us in the mists of time, they can decide that this or that food is not edible. They can taboo it. Or they can take it for some very particular reason, not really for its food value, but for some other value. It might be its furs or its feathers, or for its perceived power. People can decide that this or that chore can or cannot be done by men or by women. And that's the wild card of culture. So I often think of HBE, human behavioral ecology, as more of a learning strategy. It's a set of models that we can then bounce reality off of in an effort to try and understand how it is that the things that people do actually do make sense in an evolutionary framework.
You mentioned this a moment ago, that we can't simply look at today's foragers and assume that they are a direct window onto some kind of past, as if they're somehow frozen at a prior level of development, which I think is, for people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about today's foragers, that may be a fairly natural assumption to make. It's certainly one that we're pointed toward from kind of cultural cues. But why exactly is that misleading? Why is it misleading to say that they're a window onto the past?
Well, it's misleading because it's wrong, I suppose, is the simple answer. It's misleading because human behavior is dependent upon conditions, and the conditions of the present are not an exact replica of the conditions of the past. In some ways, yes. I mean, a person out stalking an antelope across the prairie, there are certain things about that activity which were true in the past, and they're true today, because they all have to do with the nature of antelope and how far they can see and their level of curiosity. And that was true 10,000 years ago, and it's true today. There are certain things that are true of the past. But we can't ignore the larger context that foraging peoples occupy today. So one of the things I often lecture about to my students are about the Mikea in Madagascar, which are some folks that my wife, who's also an anthropologist, she and I spent some time with back in the 90s. I can show you pictures of them, and you could look at those pictures and go, my God, this is exactly what I think prehistory would have looked like. Well, are the Mikea people that time forgot? Are they relics of the Paleolithic era? The answer is clearly no, because Madagascar was one of the last places on Earth to be occupied by humans. People are there by about AD 500. They may be there earlier. There's some archaeological data to suggest that. But that might be 1000 BC or so. And the people who arrived there arrived as horticultural folks. So the Mikea cannot be Paleolithic relics because, in fact, there is no Paleolithic in Madagascar. These are all folks who have taken up hunting and gathering as only part of their life way. They're not full-time hunter-gatherers. I doubt there's anybody in the world today who's a full-time, 100% hunter-gatherer. They took that life way up for various reasons. And some of those reasons were things like fleeing into the forest to escape the slave trade in the 16, 17, 1800s. Then when Madagascar became an independent country in the early 1960s, there was a very heavy taxes imposed on people. Well, some people fled into the forests to escape these tax collectors. And that's really why they're there today and doing what they do today. So you can't understand the Mikea without understanding the prehistory of Madagascar and without understanding the historical circumstances that they've been living under.
This makes a lot of sense. And there's a line from your book, The Lifeways of Hunter-Gatherers, that really stuck with me. On the basis of these comparisons, you say, we have drawn remarkably detailed pictures of early human society, complete with family bands of 25 people who share food, trace kin relations bilaterally, reside bilocally, and regulate their population to avoid environmental degradation. But this detailed picture comes not from archaeological evidence, but instead from ethnographic analogy. This really resonates with me because whenever I feel like I was reading kind of basic introductions to Neanderthals or to Homo erectus or even more recent Paleolithic folks in the modern humans in the upper Paleolithic, that was exactly the way that they were described. And I always just kind of assumed that there were good reasons for that. But if it's just ethnographic analogy, what are the implications of that for understanding the deeper past?
Well, one of the implications is that we have to let archaeological data speak for themselves. If you go back into the earlier archaeological literature of the 1960s and the 1950s, archaeology really had very poor methods. It had not thought about the methods for how do we extract information out of archaeological data so that we actually build up prehistory from an analysis of the stone tools and the animal bones that we find in archaeological sites. And that whole process requires a field called ethnoarchaeology, which appeared around the 1970s. And that's a field that studies the relationship between material remains and human behavior in a living context for the purpose of creating arguments to draw behavioral inferences out of archaeological data. And that's work that has to be done with living peoples, because you need to see the people living over here, and then on the other hand, to see the material remains of their behavior in order to look for arguments to link one with the other. But the second implication is that when we're studying hunting and gathering peoples, we really have to be constantly asking these why questions. Why are people behaving the way that they're behaving? Instead of just saying, here's how they're behaving, therefore, that's how people in the past must have behaved. We want to answer this why question. Because if we can answer that why question in a theoretically robust way, then we've got a good justification for making an inference from archaeological remains without necessarily having some direct evidence of that behavior that we're trying to infer. For example, a group size of about 25. This is remarkably common across hunting and gathering peoples in a variety of different environments and circumstances. There's some variation in there, of course, from maybe 18 to 30 or so. But you don't get groups of 50 or 100 who are living together all the time, that you might get a short-term group of people getting together for a big rabbit hunt or a bison drive, and everyone has a good time, eats a lot, makes friends, finds spouses, but they eventually have to break up into these smaller groups again. If we could explain why that is, then we'd have a good reason to make that assumption about prehistory. And in fact, we can do that for a group size of about 25. It's striking a balance between having enough hunters in a group of about 25 is going to have from about 4 to 7 active hunters in it. And the reason you want 4 to 7 active hunters is we can work this out mathematically in a variety of different kinds of environments. That's going to really maximize the likelihood that one of those hunters is going to bring home a kill that can be shared within the entire group. Now, you might say, well, just have lots and lots more hunters. You'll increase the amount. But if you have lots and lots of hunters, then you create a problem for the women who are doing plant gathering, because they can only go so far from camp to gather plants before it's not worth the effort. You can only go so far before you run out of enough time to make it worthwhile going out that far. And that distance is, in most cases, is not going to be much more than, say, 3 to 6 kilometers from camp. So if you have a very large group, they're very quickly going to sort of collect all the plant food within that reasonable foraging radius, and then you have to move. The larger the group is, the more frequently you're going to have to move. So 25 kind of strikes a balance, not depleting a foraging area so quickly that you're going to be moving more frequently than you'd want, but also maximizing the likelihood that one of the hunters is going to bring in a kill.
That strikes me as a really good example of the kind of model that human behavioral ecology can provide that gives us some value when we're trying to understand the archaeological record. And as I've been exploring the literature on archaeology and prehistory, that I've seen this more and more, that like with the Jomon of Japan, there's some really good work that's using human behavioral ecology to try to understand the nature of their exploitation of the environment and how and why they could be effectively sedentary in that environment. So that's the kind of thing that makes a lot of sense. At the same time, though, when we're dealing with prehistory, that gives us a dramatically larger stretch of time and a dramatically different range of environments in which people could be operating. So we reach the limits of what we can do with comparison to present day groups. Is there any way in which we can understand present foragers better by analogy to the archaeological record, or vice versa? Like, where do we run out of help, I guess, looking in either direction?
Well, we can run out of help fairly quickly when we start looking at the really deep human past, when we're perhaps dealing with our human ancestors who were not fully human in the way that everyone's human today and has been for at least the last 50,000 years, if not somewhat longer. I mean, we can go back into talking about Australopithecines or Homo erectus, and were they really human the way that you and I know humans? But that's where things can get kind of interesting. It can be a window into how are those organisms behaving and how is it similar or how is it different from what we would expect sort of living hunter-gatherers, given what we know about the full range of their behaviors, how would we expect them to behave in that circumstance? And how is it different from what the archaeology is telling us Homo erectus or Australopithecines were doing? So that's when things can get really fun, because here you're looking at an organism that's kind of human, but not really human. And you'd like to answer the question, how is it that they're not really human? What is it that's different? The other way it can become different is when we look at hunter-gatherers who are operating under circumstances that we cannot observe today. So at some time in the past, more than 13,000 years ago, probably not more than 15,000 years ago, in my opinion, humans migrated across the Bering Strait into what's now Alaska and then down probably along the Pacific coast and into North America, where they encountered two things, two circumstances of their environment were kind of interesting. One was that there were a lot of animals and a lot of really big animals, mammoths, mastodons, horses, camels, ground sloths, and so on. And there's nobody there. You get south of the ice sheets, and from there to Tierra del Fuego, there's no people. And you're moving into an environment where the animals have never known human predators. What would that be like? Now, those are fully modern people, 13,000 or 15,000 years ago. They're just like you and me. How would they have behaved? Well, this is actually a question that's kept North American archaeologists up at night for many, many years and arguing a lot about it. But it's not a situation that you can easily apply an analogy to, because there's no hunter-gatherer that we know from ethnographic data who has lived under that circumstance.
That's really interesting, because even the closest parallels to that would be like big game hunting societies of the Great Plains, and they're much more specialized because you're dealing with bison as opposed to a wider variety of large grazers. You have the horse, at least in terms of more recent times. And it's not like there weren't bison back in the day either. They were just much bigger. So even there, your closest parallels are not actually that close.
You're right. They're not that close. And again, you have to look at the whole context that people are living under. Certainly for those later bison hunters, the ones that are horse-equipped, which doesn't really happen until well into the 18th century. But they've not only got horses, which changes everything. It changes how mobile you can be and how far you can move in a day and how much stuff you can carry. It changes everything. And we see that reflected in the Native American societies of the plains. The horse just completely takes over their culture and in terms of what's important and what constitutes wealth and so on. But they're also living within a circumstance where there are agricultural peoples like the Hidatsa living along the river valleys that these hunter-gatherers, these specialized hunters really, have now got to fit into this cultural mosaic on the plains. And then you just add the crush of Europeans then moving in on them. The lives of those folks living on the plains like the Lakota or the Crow, it would have been a life of constant generational change from the 18th century on up, just massive change. So they're not a very good analogy for the people who were occupying the plains 13,000 years ago.
In kind of ethnographic accounts of those people on the plains, is something like 80 to 85% of the diet would have been hunted meat. I was really struck in Lifeways of Hunter-Gatherers by the variability in diet, that you can have groups like that where 85% of the diet is meat. You can have foragers that are 80 to 85% reliant on plant foods, others where it's 80% fishing. Given that that's the case, can we even hold any sort of idealized hunter-gatherer type in our heads? Or is variability the thing that we should be thinking of as the defining characteristic?
I think variability is really the important element. It's the important way to think about past hunter-gatherer behavior. That variability that we see today, it should have held true in the past as well, and maybe more at some times than at others. If we could take a time machine and go back to 13,000 years ago in North America. My guess is that if you could have traveled from California to New York, you would have found hunter-gatherers living in very, very similar ways in terms of subsistence, in terms of their social organization, in terms of their technology. I think they would have been very, very similar. That's what the archaeology suggests to me. But as soon as you get a growing population, and of course climate change, which radically changed the bestiary in North America, you start getting sort of region-specific lifeways appearing. Plants come into the diet in some places earlier than in other places, like in California, it shows up fairly early. Other places, it becomes a significant part of the diet somewhat later in time. But certainly by 8,000 years ago, plants are a significant part of the diet everywhere. And unlike animals, plants have very different demands and circumstances in terms of things like your seasonal timing. Where do you have to be in order to exploit rice grass versus sago lily bulbs? They have different processing requirements. So things like lots of tubers and so on. You really can't eat these things unless they're baked. And you don't get a lot of food value out of them. Cooking really converts a lot of those starches and carbohydrates into more easily digestible sugars. But animals are pretty much animals. I mean, the anatomy of a rabbit and the anatomy of a mammoth, one is just a scaled up version of the other. Cooking meat it's meat. It's all the same. But as soon as population grows, what HBE tells us is those high-ranked resources, like larger animals, start to become less frequently encountered. And as they're less frequently encountered, the models tell us people have to expand diet, and they expand the diet, including things of increasingly lower return rates. And eventually you're down collecting seeds, which really often have a pathetic return rate to them in their wild state. The interesting things about seeds is that you can work with them. Certain species you can work with, and you can make them more productive. That increases their return rate, and they sort of leapfrog their way back up to becoming a higher ranked resource, and people start to focus on them. This is the story of maize, really, which starts out as the seed head's about the size of your pinky. It's a little tiny plant down in southern Mexico. It eventually turns into, well, those huge corn fields you can drive by for hours and hours in Nebraska.
That's one of the things that's so fascinating about all this, is that a food is not just a food. A plant is not just a thing that you can pluck off. An animal is not just a thing that you can find and eat. There's the act of either stalking and hunting it or processing it is something that takes time and energy. And that's where human ingenuity and strategies and technology come into play, that we're not passive consumers of our environment. We're actively doing things that change those kind of baseline return rates based on what kind of technologies we've got available. Like if you have specialized grinding tools, you can get a lot more out of acorns than if you don't. Or like the Inuit groups you talk about in Lifeways of Hunter-Gatherers have an incredibly specialized technological toolkit that is designed for hunting seals and marine mammals and for fishing, because if you didn't have that, you couldn't live there. So the things that we have available to us and the ways that culture is allowing us to develop broad or specific technological toolkits, that changes the math of hunting and gathering.
Exactly. Technology comes into it because changes in the technology affect the return rate of resources. That technology usually requires a certain amount of investment in terms of your time. So probably one of the best examples is fishing. Most people today, if they go fishing, they go with a hook and line. This is actually a terrible way to go fishing if you really want to feed yourself, because it's slow. And it's intended to be slow because, you know, most guys are doing it as part of their Zen meditation or something. If you really want to fish, well, I'll tell you, if you really want to fish quick, the fastest way is hand grenades is the fastest way to get fish. Folks out in Micronesia learned this when they would get hand grenades from the, well, first from the Japanese and then later from American sailors during World War II. But if you're lacking hand grenades, the best way to fish is with nets. You stretch a net across a river and walk through it, or to build a fish weir across it, which is basically a dam with one opening in it that all the fish are channeled through, and then you kind of spear them as they're all coming through this one channel. Or traps made out of, usually they're kind of basketry-like traps that you can put in the water or sometimes put in tidal zones. All of that technology can work really well. It all takes a lot of time to construct and to then mend. If you live with people who do a lot of fishing, even today, their evenings are spent sitting around mending fish nets. So it's a technology that works really well, but it usually has a very big upfront cost to it. And that's especially true for the technology you need to get food out of the ocean. It's usually an expensive technology. So technology usually comes along once people have been forced to start using a particular resource which has a low return rate, but they can increase that return rate if they invest the time in the technology for it.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It gets us to this really kind of dynamic and complex relationship between environment and subsistence, technology and culture, that it's not one thing that drives another, that like kind of straightforwardly A drives B. It's all of these things are dynamically interrelated. So if you're faced with a shifting environment, maybe you just move to a place where the environment's better, but maybe you decide, well, there are these nuts here. I know that if I decide I'm going to stay in this one spot for 6 months of the year and carve out this really elaborate grindstone, then I can use these acorns after doing all of the hard work of processing them. Now I can stay in this one place. And if I'm staying in this one place, then I can develop these other kind of less portable technologies that allow me to more effectively exploit this niche. But I think there's a tendency to see that as the natural course of human history, that we're going to get more sedentary and we're going to develop more technologies that are more predicated on us having less mobility. But the other answer is always to just move and have less and to rely on mobility as that strategy. And there seems to be a point somewhere between 8 and 12,000 years ago where people made the choice to be more sedentary. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts in kind of global context, why they increasingly made those choices. Was it just a matter of population that kind of all across the world, for whatever reason, people hit population sizes that meant they had to stay put more and more effectively exploit resources? Did something change in our approach? I don't know. I ask everybody that I talk to who knows about prehistory, why this shift in that period of time and why everywhere?
Put really simply, I think the primary driving factor here is population, that hunter-gatherers benefit by moving in a number of different ways. It's a way to move into a piece of land that hasn't been exploited in a while. It's a way to move to another part of the landscape where a particular food is becoming available and to not have to transport that stuff back because it may not be worth transporting a really long distance. I think the reason that people stopped moving is because population growth had reached a point where you can't move to the next point on the landscape because there's someone already there. And of course, in order to be sedentary and remain a hunter-gatherer, you really have to settle yourself on some location where there's going to be food available pretty much year-round, or some food is going to come available that you can gather in considerable bulk and then store it for that time of the year when foods are not available. So this is the case on the northwest coast of North America, where folks like the Kwakwaka'wakw and the Tlingit and the Haida all established villages first on really good salmon streams. And then they take advantage of these massive salmon runs to get as many of those fish out as they can in a relatively short period of time and dry them and store them for the next 4 to 5 months of the winter when there's not going to be much food available on the northwest coast. And I suspect that what drives people is population growth. You just get populations get packed in. And hunter-gatherers feel that packing at what you and I would consider pretty dang low population densities. Because for the hunting and gathering lifeway to work, it really needs a lot of land for any given year and a lot of land over the course of someone's lifetime. Because they'll have to abandon some large tract of land, perhaps due to a forest fire or a prairie fire. Eventually that land will regenerate, of course. But for the time being, you have to move. Well, what if somebody's already there? You could perhaps move in with them, but at some point the population density reaches a point where your neighbors can't afford to let you in. And that's when problems arise.
As we get to a point where populations rise and you can't just move and you've got neighbors there, you have three choices. You can stick around and starve, or you can stick around and develop new ways of living in that particular spot so you get more intensified use of lower return rate resources, or you have conflict. Conflict is an option, right?
Conflict is an option, and this is certainly something that a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists have been studying in recent years for hunter-gatherers. And they ask the question, well, are hunter-gatherers violent or not? And that question has always bothered me, and it goes back to the assumption that hunter-gatherers are demonstrating basic human nature more than anyone else. So let me be absolutely clear on this. I don't think hunter-gatherers demonstrate human nature any more than you and I. Mm-hmm. They're not closer to human nature than you or I. Many people still think that because they look at them and they see, well, they're really stripped down of all these complications of modern life. So they must be what human nature is really all about. And there are others who, for whatever reason, think, let's be honest, you know, let's take the veil from our eyes and see human nature for what it is. It's nasty, brutish, and short, right? That's human life. And the answer really for hunter-gatherers is sometimes there's violence and sometimes there's not. It's really like any human life. And I'm sure they'd prefer that their lives be violence-free. Who wouldn't? If you look for other instances of warfare, of one group against another group, it seems to be relatively rare. There is individual cases of individual violence every place I've ever looked. When we do look for evidence of violence in hunting and gathering populations, it appears to correlate with population density and population pressure. Where you get larger numbers of people, that's where you get evidence of people fighting. And that's a function of competition over land that's produced by the slow growth of human populations over time.
So do you think as populations grow, you're more inclined to get not just competition between groups, but within groups as well, like competition for status and hierarchy that can express itself through violence?
Absolutely, yes. And I think some of the status competition that we see is really one individual, it's usually men, who are trying to maintain control over the access to some particularly good food resource. This is more true where the food resources are more concentrated. It's where we see more significant differences in the status of men and women. It's where we see slavery among hunter-gatherers. That's a way to capture someone's labor, but you're able to control their food intake. So all of these, they're not reflecting human nature. They're really reflecting the paths that humans choose to take under conditions of evolutionary pressure. They're all looking for an evolutionary advantage in a situation where there's not too many choices left for people.
If somebody were an archaeologist in a couple thousand years, we're digging up our remains. If you and I were buried side by side, an archaeologist might say, ah, what we have here is a lot of evidence for violence because we see a sample of two men who both have broken noses.
Right.
And which speaks to the incompleteness and the difficulty of understanding past societies through the archaeological record. Especially, I think something I've been thinking about a lot lately is just the body and how the body is used to communicate identity and status through tattooing, through a body ornamentation, through clothing, which are things that just almost never survive in the archaeological record, mm-hmm. especially the further back you go. So much of how people communicated with one another and talked to each other through the body is just completely lost to us. But it is something that we can see in through the ethnographic record. I mean, is that an area where you think we could see some parallels, or is that, again, a thing where there's just so much variability that it's hard to say?
Well, there's a great deal of variability there. I mean, in terms of things like tattooing or even cranial deformation, which is something you have to do to a child. You can't do it to an adult. So it's really reflecting this child has got a certain status at the moment that they're born, and they're going to bind boards to the head to shape the head in a particular way so that all your high-ranking peoples have heads that look different than other peoples. It's like foot binding in ancient China. So that's a really difficult thing to look at, yeah, because those things don't preserve. We can occasionally see it on bodies that are mummified, so we can see tattoos on them. Utsi, who is a man who is 5,000 years ago, got, he was actually murdered up high in the Alps, but his body got preserved just by some fortuitous circumstances, and he's got tattoos on various places on his body.
Yeah, he's got like 60 tattoos.
Yeah,
I did a whole episode on Utsi. I'm fascinated by him. And another guy, Gebelein man, who is a mummy who's been exhibited in the British Museum for a century. They just found out recently, because he's about Utsi's age. He's about 5,400 years old, somewhere in there. They put him under infrared light and saw that he has a tattoo of a Barbary sheep and a bull on his shoulder. So it's there, but it's like, you wonder, in those cases where you can see it, you wonder just how much you're missing when all you have is a skeleton and not any flesh on the bones. So literally and figuratively.
And there's not, you can't cry for the moon. I mean, if it's not there, it's not there. And you could probably pull on some ethnographic analogy, but I'd rather just work with the data that I'm really comfortable with.
Speaking of data that you have, you mentioned in an email that you are compiling a radiocarbon database. You have 102,000 dates for the lower 48 states of the United States for prehistory. As you've been working on this, you said for like 6 years, have you seen any preliminary patterns, or are you still at the stage of just getting all the dates in the database?
Well, we're sort of getting all the dates into the database and cleaning them up. And I hope we'll be all done with just a couple of months' time here. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we have seen, and we're not sure if this is real or not, is starting a little after AD 1000, there appears to be a rapid decline in the population. There's a rapid decline in the number of radiocarbon dates. And we're assuming that that's at least partly a function of a rapid decline in the human population. And we see this more or less across the lower 48 states. We still have a lot of work here to figure out what's behind that. It could reflect the fact that as you get closer to the present, archaeologists start using other methods of dating archaeological sites. So in the American Southwest, they can use tree rings to date archaeological sites, because the folks there built pueblos and they incorporated these whole trees as roof beams in them. So we can date them to the year that the tree was cut down. They also use a technique called archaeomag dating in the Southwest. In other places, as you move into the historic period, sites are dated by European trade goods showing up in them. That's actually better than radiocarbon dating. It can give you a better estimate of the age than a radiocarbon date. So we have to figure out if that decline is a product of those things, archaeologists using other methods to date sites. I tend to think not, because the decline starts too early, more on AD 1000, 1100 or so. So that's something that we're going to be investigating later this year.
I'm so fascinated by that, because as I've been looking at prehistory, summed radiocarbon probabilities and using that as a proxy for population as our best way of understanding kind of prehistoric demography seems to be a method that people are using more and more. And I would say, based on kind of parallels elsewhere, the idea of a population decline is not like, it's not out of the question. Populations rise and fall all the time, it seems to me, that that's just kind of a thing that happens, whether it's based on environmental degradation or global shift in environmental conditions, or just, you know, intergroup conflict and people getting mad at each other and disease also. Yeah. I mean, that just like that our numbers kind of rise and fall. And over the past couple of centuries, we've gotten locked into this idea that populations are always rising and there are always going to be more people than there were a year or 5 years or a century before. But that's not always the way that it's worked over the long run.
No, it hasn't. And we can see this, though. European archaeologists have been able to see this. Once agriculture comes onto the scene, we often think it's this great advance, and it does indeed allow a population to increase more rapidly over the short term. But then you appear to hit these crashes where the population declines significantly, and then it has to start climbing back up again. So a hunter-gatherer population usually has fluctuations in it. It goes up and down, but not enormously. Populations just don't grow very rapidly. We've calculated that the growth rate over long spans of time of hunter-gatherers is something like 0.04%. That's really, really low. I mean, when you consider that world population growth hit its peak in the 1960s, I think it was around 2.1% or so. So hunter-gatherer growth rates are really, really low. Agriculture may have produced the situation where, yes, you can increase the growth rate over the short term, which looks like a good thing, but then you have a devastatingly bad harvest, the land becomes unproductive, and you have to move on to new land, and you have this dramatic population decline.
Yeah, I interviewed Stephen Shannon a couple of months ago, who's done a ton of work on that. And he and I were talking about this. It's not even just that you see like one rise and drop off. It's this constant. Ongoing cycle with these early agricultural societies where populations rise and then they crash and they rise and then they crash and they rise and then they crash. And you can see it in the archaeological record. You can see it in pollen records. You can see it even a little bit, not as quite as high a resolution yet, but probably will soon, in the genetic data, where you see local population replacements happening all the time, where one group is there, they're there for a couple of centuries. I'm thinking about like the linear pottery people. You have a group that comes in, their population expands rapidly, they colonize a large stretch of land, and then their way of life, for whatever reason, it stops working. In that case, there's huge massacre sites. There's just tons and tons and tons of dead people that you find in a ditch somewhere. And their society more or less collapses. And then the people who come a couple of centuries after them are not the same people. They're slightly related to them, but they're not the same group anymore. And so I wonder, is agriculture just speeding that up? Is it just a more like dramatic version of processes that are happening all the time? Or is it something fundamentally different? I have no idea.
The long-term growth rate of those agricultural populations, they can have periods when their population grows rapidly because they do have these collapses. The long-term rate, surprisingly, is still about 0.04%. And that rate probably held true into the 19th century, because even though people were having much, much larger families than hunter-gatherers have, you still had 50 to 60% of children dying into the 19th century. Two things happened in the 19th century. One was advances in medical technology that saved a lot of those children from dying, antibiotics and so on. But also humans tapped into another source of solar energy, stored solar energy, which is fossil fuels. And this allowed us to be much more productive in many different ways. And it allowed us to move food around the globe much more easily, so that one place that's having a famine, okay, there's a way to sort of cart food into there relatively quickly. So mortality really, really declines. And the result has been, since the 19th century, astounding population growth. It took us 6 million years as a species to reach a global population of 1 billion sometime in the 19th century. Since that time, we've doubled, and we're going to double again maybe next week. It's really, really soon. And by the end of the century, demographers predict somewhere between 11 and 12 billion people. Unless something really dramatic happens, that's where we're going to be in another 80 years.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
I've done a lot of work on late medieval Europe over the years and on the Black Death and on environmental changes in the later Middle Ages. And so the medieval demographers talking about the shift in mortality regime that goes along with the Black Death. You go from a lower mortality to a higher mortality regime, even as birth rates remain relatively constant. And like, it's all a high mortality regime. But around the edges, those differences matter a little bit for decreasing and maintaining a lower population over time. But it's still a very, very high mortality. It was a high mortality before the Black Death. It was a high mortality after the Black Death, all the way up into the 19th century. One of the things I think always shocks lay people is that the extent to which cities were net consumers of people, basically up into the middle of the 19th or even the turn of the 20th centuries before modern sanitation, that cities were just like meat grinders that you had to keep pumping people into because the birth rates in cities were lower than the death rates, always.
Yeah. And that's partly a function of the early days of capitalism, where people were considered to be expendable. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. They really didn't care.
So I had two more things I wanted to ask you about. First, you mentioned in your email that you would like to be doing more ice patch archaeology in the time that you have. So what exactly is ice patch archaeology?
There are, at higher altitudes in the mountains all over the world, there are glaciers, of course, but there are also ice patches. These are sort of big, huge patches of ice and snow that maybe someday hope to grow up and be a glacier. But their advantage is that they're not moving. They can be huge. I've seen some that are just enormous, but they're not moving. They're not big enough to move yet. They don't have the weight to really start pushing down the hillside. So that makes them really handy because anything that gets stuck in them doesn't get ground up into pulp. Glaciers just grind up everything that goes into them. So they're not very helpful. But ice patches will just hold this stuff. With global warming happening, and this is one evidence that global warming is real, these ice patches have started to melt back. And as they melt back, these artifacts that are in them are just, they're tumbling out. Either they just fall out on the ground in front of the ice patches, or they get washed a little ways down the streams that always emanate out of these ice patches. And it's often organic artifacts that are preserved in literally a deep freeze. And some of these, the oldest artifact found out of an ice patch was found by a colleague of mine, a fellow named Craig Lee, who I consider to be really the world's expert on ice patches. He found an atlatl dart that's about 10,000 years old that came out of an ice patch up north of Yellowstone in the mountains north of there.
Oh my goodness. Has anybody ever even found projectile points? Has anybody ever found the actual dart?
There are a few cases in really dry caves. Usually what we find is the foreshafts to them, the atlatl shaft itself. It may just be cane, which being very light doesn't preserve very, very well. But the foreshaft to it, this short, sort of short, usually hardwood, which the projectile point is, it's fixed onto that. Mm-hmm. And it fits into a socket in the main shaft. The main shaft can be 4 feet long. Atlatl darts are usually quite long. And somebody could then carry a whole bunch of foreshafts, but carrying relatively few main shafts, because you take it, you throw the atlatl dart into a critter, and usually what happens is the foreshaft stays in the animal. The main shaft drops away, you come along, scoop it up, stick another foreshaft into it, and you're ready to go. So full atlatl darts those are relatively rare to find. There have been some in dry caves, which is the other place you can get great preservation, is where it stays perfectly dry. But others have found a number of at least foreshafts in these ice patches.
That's wild. That's the kind of thing. You got to do that fast. If you don't go and get that stuff, it's just going to rot away.
Right. Within a certain amount of time, it will rot. So there's a certain level of urgency to it. So some of these ice patches, the researchers try and go back to them repeatedly, year after year, usually in about late summer, early fall, before the next year's snowfall starts, because then it covers everything up. They'll go back and keep checking these. There's some in Norway that have been productive for really the last 20 years. They just keep going back and keep finding more and more stuff. The ones in Norway are, they get so many arrows out of them that they're not excited when they find arrows. I would be excited. They get sleds, they get shoes, they get tunics, they get horses that have got metal shoes on them. They find all kinds of stuff from these patches in Norway, especially medieval era stuff.
Oh my God. And that's a literal embarrassment of riches. And it's just stuff you just don't get and you wish you got more of. I mean, I'm always fascinated by the preservation of organic remains because it doesn't happen very often. Like I've talked to people who have excavated at Vindolanda along Hadrian's Wall in Britain, and there you get waterlogged conditions. So you get things like shoes, wooden writing tablets that preserve. I mean, Ötzi is my favorite. I spent a whole episode talking about Ötzi. I love him so dearly.
You should go to the museum that has Ötzi in it in Italy.
I would absolutely love to do that. Is it in Bolzano?
Bolzano, Italy. Yeah, they did a very good job. Very good job. And it's just, for an archaeologist, it's mind-boggling because if you take everything that's with Ötzi and reduce it down to what usually preserves in the archaeological record, you could hold it in one hand. And you look at it and you go, my God, the stone tools here are nothing. There's all these arrows and the tunics and the shoes and the hat and the backpack frame. And that's what you focus on when you're there and you realize, my goodness, we're missing so much in your average run-of-the-mill archaeological site.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He gives you Ötzi and those spectacular moments of preservation. It just gives you a sense for the richness that you're missing otherwise. Yeah. And then it's mind-boggling to realize just how much there is, that every skeleton had all of that stuff. You know, every person was surrounded by a much greater variety of material culture than we can ever see. Okay, so I have one more question I wanted to ask you about. I really enjoyed your book, The Fifth Beginning. You're basically looking at humanity with some real long-term perspective over the course of 6 million years. You don't get that when you're looking at, you know, years, decades, even centuries. In that book, you feel pretty dang optimistic about our future as human beings. Why is that? Please talk me off the ledge.
Well, I'd have to say I'm not an inherently optimistic person. And that book was published in 2016. Its publication date was literally 1 week after the 2016 election. And I was not happy. So, yeah, I tend to be a pessimistic person. But I find pessimism to be a useless approach. It directs you to inaction. And I've read too many books, many about climate change and what's going to happen. And usually the books end up with, you know, we're screwed. There's really nothing we can do about it. And they're right. We can't, if we stopped putting carbon into the atmosphere today, zero, make it completely zero. The estimates are it would take about 500 years for the world to get back to where we were just in 1950. But I read these books and I go, well, there's nothing that can be done, so I won't do anything. You have to take an optimistic approach in order to tell people, look, it's still within our control. It's within our hands to do something to fix the problems in the world. So I take an optimistic approach. But I also take an optimistic approach because what I do in that book is I show that the humanity has gone through these dramatic, really massive changes at least four times in the past, with the origins of technology, the origins of culture, the origins of agriculture, and the origins of the state. And this dramatically changed the nature of human life. And most of my students, they really assume that the way things are now is pretty much the way that they're going to be forever and ever. Yes, they accept the fact that there were changes in the past, but they kind of see that as sort of like our humanity's childhood. But now we're done growing up. Here's where we are. It's not so good, but that's the way it's going to be forever and ever. And the answer is no. The answer is when we look at the signals of dramatic change in humanity, it's registered in a significant change in the nature of the human footprint on the face of the planet. And in the book, I go through what all of how this is evidenced, the first four beginnings. And then I just say, look around the world today. In the last 500 years, and especially in just the last century or two, the nature of human footprint on Earth has changed really dramatically. That in the future, archaeologists 10,000 years from now, when they look back, they're going to look at this period of time and go, that's a period of time when there was something very dramatic happening. So I would say that what we have now is not what's going to continue into the future. And these things are driven by population growth, and population growth is about to go through the roof. So we've got all the indicators that we're in the midst of a very significant change in the nature of human life. And that could be really bad news. I mean, maybe we're looking at the Borg or something like that, you know? But it could also be a really, really good thing. It could be humanity's finest moment when we finally get our act together, learn how to solve problems through some means other than warfare, and we can take the $900 billion Pentagon budget and unleash it onto other problems that we have to solve. And if everyone in the world did that, my goodness.
I'm fascinated by this point because I too am a pessimistic person, but I would like to be optimistic about the future. And, you know, we've lived through enormous upheavals before. And in the grand scheme of things, you mentioned 500 years to get us back to where we were in 1950. 500 years is a blink of an eye. Yeah. That's practically no time at all. And that's one of the reasons I love prehistory. It's one of the reasons the ethnographic record is so useful. It's one of the reasons that kind of the broad span of human history is so useful, that you recognize that, like, unless we really, 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 really screw things up, there are going to be people here in 500 years, and they're going to be living with the consequences of what we do now.
Yeah, absolutely true. Like I said, it could be humanity's finest moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no reason that it can't be.
Yeah. If you exclude that from the range of possibilities at the get-go, if you just say that nothing good can happen, then nothing good will happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have to remain optimistic and working in the right direction.
Now, on that note, Professor, thank you so much for your time. This was an absolute pleasure. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this conversation.
It was a pleasure to do it.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new kids and family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.